You are listening to Free Radio Olympia. Here at the Thunderbolt, I tend to cover a lot of controversial topics from controversial points of view. And therefore, some of the other folks that work with this radio station always appreciate it when I point out that while they may agree with the views expressed on this program, they also very well may not. And in either case, they are in no way responsible for that content. Therefore, if my show makes you want to start hurling blunt objects at people, then make sure you choose the correct target, which in this case would be me, not them. And now, on with the show! Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day, you turned on your radio, and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids. The Thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee!
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Jekka, and this is Pretty Girls Are People Too. That's right. I said it. I'm a pretty girl. I like dresses. I wear makeup. I had surgery to get the perfect double D's, and I haven't eaten solid food since 2008 because if I didn't have thigh gap, I'd die. But I'm just living my life, entering beauty pageants, then being mad when construction workers wolf whistle at me. Is it my fault that my being really pretty distracts you? Actually, nope. It's totally not. Grow up. Join me after the break when we discuss the important question. Am I too pretty to play volleyball? Don't get it twisted, get it twisted.
This my shit. Hey, people. Welcome to the Thunderbolt for March 5th, 2021. So as you may or may not know, company towns used to be a common feature of the American economy. Some company would open a mine or something in some isolated locale, and then that same company would also own the only store in town. That same company would also own all of the housing in town. And indeed, the workers were often paid in scrip that was only redeemable at the company store. So they could not even take an out-of-town shopping trip.
In the end, what do we find?
Another common feature of this system was that the workers often had to purchase their own tools and equipment, and thus often ended up owing the company store more than they could repay, requiring them to take out loans, which loans, again,
were conveniently provided by the very same company that provided them with everything else. And after that,
in the end,
they were trapped. Yes, people, this is the original instance of one-stop shopping. Well, it turns out that this economic model is nothing new. It turns out that in the year 74 CE, there was a Roman soldier named Gaius Messius who participated in the siege of Masada. Other than the fact that the defenders of Masada eventually made things relatively easy for the Roman soldiers by committing mass suicide, it's a pretty sure bet that Mr. Messius was ready, willing, and able to slaughter the denizens of Masada were he ordered to do so. So what was he paid? You may ask. Well, we know about Gaius Messius because archaeologists recently discovered a receipt showing that Gaius Messius received 50 denarii as a stipend for his services.
Satisfy his desire for immortality. He does not grasp the full significance of this simple survival formula.
But according to Mr. Messius, I received my stipendium of 50 denarii, out of which I have paid barley money of 16 denarii, food expenses 20 denarii, boots 5 denarii, leather strappings 2 denarii, a linen tunic 7 denarii. Yes, people, it all adds up.
In the end, what do we find?
And in another discovery that turned out to be not so ancient, an archaeologist from the Royal British Columbia Museum named Grant Keddie, K-E-D-D-I-E, who is widely acknowledged as a highly accomplished and respected practitioner in his field. However, Mr. Keddie is not so accomplished when it comes to how he should respond to F-ups, since Grant Keddie recently misidentified a carved stone figure found on a Western Canadian beach as a Native American Lekwungen artifact from the 19th century. His pronouncement was unquestioned until a Canadian sculptor named Ray Boudreau said that actually he had carved that statue in 2017. Mr. Boudreau even had pictures. It is so weird that so many people fail to realize the advantage of simply admitting mistakes rather than trying to cover them up, since so often the cover-up becomes a much bigger issue than whatever the original sin was. Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton all come to mind as people who should have taken that strategy to heart. All of those men were discredited, not so much for what they actually did, as they were for lying about what they did in their futile attempts to cover up what they did. The carving in question evidently does indeed closer resemble similar statues carved by the Lekwungen people during the 19th century. So the mistake was understandable. But rather than admitting his mistake, Grant Keddy instead simply deleted his post from the university's website without saying anything about anything to anyone, evidently thinking that he could simply get away with doing that. And so, predictably, evidently except by Mr. Keddy anyway, this attempted cover-up thus transformed what would have been some egg on Mr. Keddy's face unnoticed outside his small circle of academics into a national scandal that has now engulfed the entirety of Canada and is now receiving mention here in the Thunderbolt. Not that big a thing, dude. All right, next, we are going to contemplate the question, who needs who around here? That is actually an easy question to answer. They need us. We not only do not need them, but we would be much better off without them. And that is our advantage. For you see, a few tens of thousands of people can only bully 7 billion people if a large majority of those 7 billion people are willing to go along with the deal. They can only get away with all the heinous things they do because all the rest of us let them get away with those things. And that is only because, thanks to their almost complete control of the information flow for many decades now, hardly anyone knows what is actually going on, nor do they know how all of these things actually work. Ironically, a lot of the fake news coming through social media these days is being manufactured because their endless lies have quit making sense to a lot of people. And the propaganda machine is now seeking alternative explanations that do make sense. And with even more irony, the propaganda machine is also most happy to supply all of those fake explanations as well, since the hoopla over the fake conspiracies helps to cover up the actual conspiracies. And in addition, when conspiracy theories are automatically associated with crazy people, but that makes it much easier to discredit all of the actual researchers and actual journalists who are investigating actual conspiracies. Anyway, there are a lot of people, especially youngsters, who are figuring out all of this stuff. While there are indeed a lot of people who are still drinking a lot of Kool-Aid these days, there are also a lot of other people who are starting to figure out a lot of things. And the funny thing is that most of the real information is actually out there. and it's not really all that hard to find. You just need to know where to look. That's why you need radio stations like the one you are currently listening to. And that's why you need radio shows like the one that you are currently listening to. So I would suggest that you continue listening to both. Though I guess I'm not really an impartial source on that. Since I have always lived a very alternative lifestyle, and since I have lived most of that lifestyle in a very public manner, I have had a lot of police encounters that have ended up with me in jail. Now keep in mind, I never actually had a police record until I was convicted for pot in 1998. And I can tell you stories for hours about how and why I went to jail so often, so many times over all those preceding years without ever obtaining a police record. But usually it involved being arrested for refusing to kiss some cop's butt so he could impose upon me the pain in the ass involved of being arrested, even though the cop knew there would never be any actual charges and that I would be released after the legal 2 business days that they are allowed to hold a suspect without charging them for anything. If you're arrested on a Friday, then that means 4 days in jail before they have to release you. Then, after 1998, I spent a lot of time in jails and in prisons as a result of my marijuana smuggling activities during those years. Whatever. The point is, I can assure you firsthand, the county jails in the United States are almost invariably dark, dank, cold, ugly cement holes that are stuffed chock full of thoroughly hostile a-holes and psychopaths. In addition, you also need to keep an eye on some of the other inmates, as some of them are just as bad. Now I've also been arrested and jailed twice in Canada. The second time was in 2001 when I was arrested for suspicion of conspiracy to export marijuana. But since they didn't have any evidence, then I only spent one night in a little holding cell at a rural RCMP station. The next morning, a prosecutor said they would drop their charges if I agreed to immediately leave Canada, to which I immediately agreed. Whereupon, they immediately draped me in chains and delivered me to the border and into the loving arms of the United States government, who arrested me for conspiracy to import marijuana. They didn't have any evidence either, but unlike in Canada, in the United States, all the feds need is the unsubstantiated word of coerced snitches in order to convict you. So they didn't need any evidence. My very first Canadian experience, though, was all the way back in 1983, when I was arrested for illegally working. Yes, people, before I was a marijuana smuggler, I was an undocumented alien. Rather than calling us wetbacks, Americans living illegally in Canada were sometimes referred to as frostbacks. Since I was busted for working at a hotel laundry room, upon arrival at the jail, I was joking that I had been arrested for felonious sheet folding. Yes, I'd been working in a resort town called Jasper, which is a very small town in northern Alberta. And the thing about northern Alberta is that there are lots and lots of landscapes that are utterly devoid of humanity, which is one of the things I like about it. But therefore, also unlike the United States, it doesn't pay to build jails and prisons everywhere. And whenever possible, Canadians generally prefer other methods of dealing with things anyway. Yes, the United States is a complete outlier as far as incarcerating people goes. We are not only number one in jailing our citizens, both in total numbers and per capita, but we are number one by a very long shot. We incarcerate 6.55% of our population. Canada comes in at 1.07%. Therefore, since Jasper had only a small temporary holding cell rather than a jail, I was flown over 200 miles to Edmonton in order to adjudicate my case of felonious sheet folding. Said adjudication ending with the same outcome as my later arrest, which was with me agreeing to voluntarily leave Canada. Though the first time they allowed me to leave on my own devices, they gave me 5 days so I could go back to Jasper, gather my girlfriend and my stuff, and they also provided a form that I was instructed to turn into Canadian Customs at the border upon my exit in order to prove that I had indeed left, which I did indeed subsequently do. Anyway, the point here is that the jail in Edmonton that I stayed in was more like a frigging motel room than a jail. The walls and the floors were clean and graffiti-free, and the unit I was kept in came complete with pool tables, an in-unit library, cable TV, and they even had frigging carpeting in the day room. All of the guards and all of the inmates were all friendly with each other, and in another stark contrast to American jails, except for a handful of Native Americans, everyone in this jail was white. So, there are a few things you should know about Canada. For one thing, they have no need to incarcerate such large swaths of their population. Largely, because Canada basically does not allow poverty. Anyone who does not have an income can apply for government checks that will take care of the rent and food. And almost anyone that is academically qualified and wants to go to college can do so. And therefore, Canada is one of the most educated countries in the world, and Canada does not have hordes of desperately poor people pillaging and plundering everywhere. The only homeless people are substance abusers who spend their welfare checks on drugs or alcohol. But since there seems to be a rescue mission on every other block, then even the unhoused are still well-fed, well-dressed, The violent crime rates in Canada, as well as the overall crime rates, come in at a tiny fraction of what they are in the United States. Anyway, I bring all this up because recently a woman who had been arrested on a Vancouver Island later sent a thank you note to the jailers, giving them a glowing 4.5-star review for her stay in their local jail. She said, quote, "I wanted to let you know that I appreciated how helpful and kind everyone was, especially the 4 jailers who do a tough job and are often underappreciated by the people who are in their care." Unquote. Underappreciated. In their care. Canadians. I somehow doubt that many American jail guards have ever had such things said about any of them. Treating human beings as if they were human beings? What a thoroughly radical idea. And it's time to take a quick station break. The Thunderbolt will return in just a moment. The views expressed on the Thunderbolt are my views, and no one else's. Those views do not necessarily reflect the views of any of the stations that air the Thunderbolt, nor anybody that has anything to do with any of those stations. And now, back to the Thunderbolt. All right. So last October, Johns Hopkins University, in conjunction with the World Economic Forum, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Johnson & Johnson, and some other ruling class heavy hitters, now very famously staged a, quote, pandemic simulation, unquote, that was labeled Event 201. And many researchers have now fingered Event 201 as the replica drill that so often coincides with a false flag event. However, according to Helen Byniski, B-U-Y-N-I-S-K-I, writing for Global Research News, quote, "Few are aware that the epidemic playing out in China and 24 other countries, including the U.S., is unfolding in line with a decade-old simulation titled Lockstep, devised by the Rockefeller Foundation in conjunction with the Global Business Network. The scenario, one of 4 that were included in a 2010 publication called Scenarios for the Future of Technology and International Development, describes a coronavirus-like pandemic that becomes the trigger for the imposition of police state controls upon movement, the economy, and other areas of society." unquote. A terrified citizenry is ever ready to give up their freedom and liberties in return for protection from existential threats. And that has proven to be true, whether or not those threats actually exist. If you can sufficiently alarm the public, then that public becomes not only tolerant of, but they will actually beg for top-down direction and oversight. And once 5G makes real-time total surveillance of all cities a reality, any popular uprisings aimed at the technocratic police state that is envisioned by their simulation would be all but impossible. And this represents one of the Rockefeller Foundation's most cherished dreams. Thanks to the pandemic, they now have blanket travel restrictions in place. There looks to be a rapid drive to institute some kind of worldwide system of mandatory digital tracking done under the auspices of global health and spearheaded by the utterly corrupt World Health Organization. And of course, they will be backed by participating governments and the usual suspects in mega corporation world. They will be rolling out these new health surveillance systems. Many of the elite mouthpieces are already talking about restricting the basic freedom of movement within society by requiring a, quote, immunity passport, unquote, before you can travel anywhere, especially internationally. And another factor at play here is that the U.S. military has been seeking genetically targeted weapons for at least 50 years, especially since the George W. Bush administration described gene-specific bioweapons as a, quote, politically useful tool, unquote. Ultimately, though, you can refer to that oldest of maxims. Follow the money. Throughout the Obama administration, I reported upon the fact that Barack Obama was helping to orchestrate the largest redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top in all human history. It was probably the most effective tool Goldman Sachs ever unleashed upon us.
You catch it once. Catch it twice, catch it with your love device. Man eating, God creator, collecting lives. Pay it later, rip that thing into the rice. Office, messing with the girls ain't not enough. You can't lock it in, no one's too high. It's busting out into the sky.
Well, coronavirus has not only exacerbated that redistribution of wealth by several orders of magnitude, but at the same time, it is placing civil liberties upon the chopping block. and vastly increasing government power over people's personal lives, thus severely limiting our ability to actually do anything about anything. Yes, people, this is the shock doctrine on steroids. The pandemic and the response to the pandemic has utterly devastated the poor, racial minorities, and women. Whilst the 0.1% has experienced the largest increase in wealth and income in history. And while Wall Street has been shattering all records for profits.
I'm a rock and roll muscle with the bass guitar. My face is all out, you've gone too far. Been sleeping for a million years or longer. You won't be up, I'm even stronger. Cleaning out the face of Earth, my mother. You'll never have another. Blown to pieces, drowned in slime. Not worth the tombstone, sign of the time.
Across our world, we are experiencing economic and social displacement, the likes of which humanity has never before seen. Countries have voluntarily imploded their economies and placed most of their populations under house arrest, and moves that will have a lasting impact not only on our national economies and upon our civil liberties, but also the global economy and global civil liberties. This is going to be for years or even decades to come. In terms of scale, the damage caused to markets and small businesses and our basic freedom has already surpassed the 2008 financial crisis by orders of magnitude. And currently, there is still no end in sight. According to journalist Patrick Henningsen, quote, the net effect of immediately putting millions of workers on the government welfare rolls and pushing hundreds of thousands of small to medium-sized businesses into bankruptcy will be the largest consolidation and transfer of wealth in modern history. Yes, those with enough capital to ride out the crisis will be able to buy up companies and even whole industries for literally pennies on the dollar. And monopolies such as Amazon, Google, and telecom giants
will consolidate and solidify their market shares as competitors gradually die off and are swallowed up in receivership.
And formerly independent contractors will now be reliant upon government assistance, as will any business qualifying for government relief grants and loans. Large corporations will now have governments covering the costs of their payrolls for the duration of the crisis. For individuals and families, this means your savings are wiped out, your property collapses in value, and your future prospects are dim, at least in the short to midterm. And you will have no choice but to load up on personal and family debt to survive. Yes, people, it's like I said, this is the shock doctrine on steroids. Maybe you could follow my plan and buy a school bus so you can fix it up to live in. Or maybe you can afford to purchase one of those survival pods and hide underground for a year while your planet self-destructs. I suspect that neither one of those tactics will actually work in the long run, but whatever. It is time to get to work. And that's it for the news and commentary section this week. I'm going to fill out the rest of the hour with some music. This is Sean Phillips.
The glow around your face when you see the lightning rays. I know I'm very near, and I can hear the thunder. Of perplexity, a woman for eternity, a woman of the land, a woman. I'm saying, please believe me, it's hard to fall out of love completely. It's hard. Find a way to come back discreetly, to speak things anew.
mama. When you're coming home, mama, you don't have to roam. Mama, you know I'm coming home. If you look over there, babe, you know you might find something over there gonna blow your mind. Mama, when you're coming home, mama, it's another day, mama, you know that you can't stay, you can't stay. Yes, I keep on telling you to keep on keeping on, keep on telling you to work it on now. Keep on telling you to keep on keeping on, keep on telling you to work it on now. Mama, it's another day.
shadows and the tremors of the night, while he creeps among the alleys bringing fear before the fight. She sleeps in tattered trousers in the ballroom's decadence, moaning gently of her dreaming by escorted precedence.
antiquated babblings from a constant stream of thought, sensitively wringing out the rags that he has caught. Patting yet her bulging belly, she so slowly cries a smile in anticipated suffering of her slowly growing child. He is speeding in a vacuum, going nowhere, but of course he might believe in discipline of a bloody kind of sort. Naturally a state of race, a never-changing spate of hate, while everything in some weird way does manage to relate. To her it doesn't matter more, its chasms have been leapt, and she leans upon the skepticism of a chosen fate. Stand tall, you spittle-smattered son of man, stand up, you hear them say. To slap you down and kick your teeth and smile across the bay. Relevant, eloquent pleading wasn't what she did this year. She passed it by and told a lie and shed a crystal tear for him to see from valley's edge, from plateaus in the sand. And yet he has beshit himself for being just a man. A bragging, drawing sort of twit, a cast-off shade of pink, who's brought himself and all the rest unto the very brink. That magic urge continues on in place continuum, a song of pleasure and of pain, until that will be done.
All right. That was called Was That from Sean Phillips. Before that, we had Sleepwalker. Before that, we had Keep On. And before that, we have a song, She Was Waiting for Her Mother at the Station, that is actually a much longer name, but it's so long, I'm not going to read it all here. And those first three songs all kind of melded together, but they were separate songs. So, that's it for the show this week. Hope to see you back next week. I have fun making these. I hope you have fun listening. And one last note here. Please keep in mind that the views expressed on the Thunderbolt are those of the show's host, and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station or anyone associated with this radio station. The Thunderbolt website is dana98501.wordpress.com. 98501 is the downtown Olympia zip code, if that helps you remember that. And you can contribute to the Thunderbolt cause at patreon.com/thethunderbolt. Glad you joined us this week. We hope to see you next week. And in the meanwhile...
Thank you very much.